Welcome to the STFM podcast, brought to you by the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine. In this podcast, we speak to leaders in academic family medicine about a variety of leadership topics. And now your host, Dr. Saria Carter Sikosia.
And today, another fantastic, engaging guest. In fact, I say another, also a repeat guest to our Society of Teachers of Family Medicine podcast. Welcome once again, Dr. Renee Critchlow.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Sikosia. I really enjoy coming to STFN's podcast. You guys do good stuff.
And one that I always take copious notes. So I'm looking forward to your words of wisdom today, Dr. Critchlow. And many of us know of you, and have heard from you. However, there may be a few folks who don't know who Dr. Renee Critchlow is yet. As our president of the Society of Teachers Family Medicine, and the impact and influence you have not only on family medicine, medical students, but learners throughout the country. Can you share with us a little bit of your journey becoming a family physician and then your path forward?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And I think we all have our stories to get where we are. I think family medicine, we always have very similar stories in some ways. I remember the first thing I wanted to be when I was a little, I remember writing it in my book when I was like in first grade. I wanted to be a rodeo rider, which was curious because I was incapable of riding horses. But I grew up in Oklahoma, and it just seemed like something that someone would do. And then I got very into marine biology because of Jacques Cousteau. And he had a huge influence on me. For those of you not of our generation, there was a great show. I think it was every Sunday night. And this crew of Jacques Cousteau would take his boat out, and they would do underwater pictures. And so it just seemed so amazing. It was so enriching. And it was like, oh, I definitely want to be, I'm going to definitely be a marine biologist, and I'm going to work for Jacques Cousteau. That didn't happen. I remember the next thing was I wanted to be a geologist. My father was a petroleum engineer, and I very often would go to his department. And I thought the geologists were the coolest ones there because they had rocks. And at one point, I had a massive rock collection. I could tell you any kind of mineral just by looking at it or scraping it on the appropriate thing. I was very, very technical as a, 10-year-old. And it just seemed like the best thing. It was like rocks. All the geologists enjoyed the rocks, and they had picnics a lot. That's all I thought about geologists. Come to find out, as I got older, one of the things that routinely happened to me is people would just always express emotion to me. Folks would just spill their guts to me. I would be like, I am a first grader. You don't have to tell me all these things. But it never stopped happening. People who I didn't know felt very safe in telling me things that they needed to say. And I remember I was about 12 or 13. I was hanging out with Mrs. Rutherford, who was our across-the-street neighbor, and waiting for Scott Rutherford, who was my best friend, to get ready. Mrs. Rutherford served a sandwich, because that's what you did back then. When you went to Mrs. Rutherford's house, you always got a sandwich. And she said, Renee, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, well, Mrs. Rutherford, people really feel safe talking to me, and I really like science, so maybe I'll be a doctor. And she looked at me and she said, Renee, you'll be an excellent doctor. And I thought to myself, well, Mrs. Rutherford she's a surgical nurse. She knows doctors. If she says I'll be an excellent doctor, then clearly I'll be an excellent doctor. And growing up in Oklahoma, the docs we saw were the same, you went to the doctor, same doctor that your parents went to. And all the people on TV saw everybody. And when I finally got into medical school, I remember someone asking, well, it was like first day. You just finish your class picture and they're like, so what's your specialty? I was like, well, I'm going to be a doctor. And they're like, what kind of doctor? I'm like, a doctor, the one that takes care of the people. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, babies, all the people, old people, all the stuff. And they're like, oh, you must be family medicine. I was like, yeah, that's what it is. Totally. I knew that. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard similar stories from people, but it kept reinforcing itself. The faculty that I engaged with were just amazing. And, Dr. Day and Dr. Tanji, Dr. Patakis were all these just driven, passionate folks who cared about their patient right in front of them, but also cared about community and the society that we lived in. I was just like, this is what being a doctor should be. And I felt really fortunate that I could stay and do residency there at UC Davis, because it was really a place where family medicine wasn't just appreciated or valued. It was like a cornerstone, almost. The idea that you could do full spectrum family medicine was just a given. And I felt it was constantly reinforced. And when I got to say my third year of medical school, I just loved everything. And I was like, oh, I'm definitely a family doc. And I've never regretted it.
Wow. Well, Mrs. Rutherford definitely knew what she was talking about when she said you would be an excellent doctor. And listening to your path, I'd never heard the part about wanting to be a rodeo rider. And I like that. Perhaps it's specific to your geography, but where you grew up. But I think it also maybe speaks to family medicine. It can be a rocky ride out there from time to time, but we hold on and we endear ourselves to the people that we support. And I love how you introduce what family medicine is. Yeah. I want to be the one that takes care of the people. And that is...
And it worked out. And so the funny thing about it is one of my first papers was actually on injuries and rough stock riders for rodeo. And I never realized that until just now. So maybe that was my contribution to rodeo.
It's there forever and always. And we will remember that. And you alluded to generations before. I do remember Sunday evenings with Jacques Cousteau. My father was a very passionate follower of Jacques Cousteau, as well as an explorer of the under the sea world. And I think over generations, we continue to maintain that curiosity of the great unknown. And oftentimes that's what we explore and see in family medicine. And as we evolve through these different generations of medicine, whether you know Jacques Cousteau or not, I'm sure what you see is that there is a new future. There is something coming before us, the unknown that's ahead of us. And in your Society of Teachers of Family Medicine address, you speak to new professionalism. What is new professionalism? Where are we headed in the unknown?
Well, The unknown is the path that family medicine guides people on the best. So we're very fortunate. And I'd say that where we are right now, there's a massive generational paradigm shift in what professionalism is. As you and I remember when you were coming up, if you were sick, you went to work. If it was your kid's birthday, you went to work. It was sacrifice, 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 sacrifice. That's the only way you can take good care of your patients, is if nothing else matters. And in doing that, we were put in places where we were told that our emotions shouldn't show up at work. We were told that it's weak to care more than beyond the exact question that you're supposed to answer for this patient, that crying has no place in the workplace, that actually feelings had no place in the workplace. And that was pretty much constantly reinforced. And, you know, the boomers were trained that way, and they trained us in the Gen X that way. And a lot of that kept carrying over. And I think the first time I ever took a day off from work because I was sick, I had influenza A and a fever. And it was when I was, a faculty, 4 years in the faculty, I was like, wait a second, I'm sick. I'm supposed to stay home. And that was hard. That was really hard. And the only reason I was able to do it was because I was, my learners were teaching me, no, you have to take care of yourself or you can't take care of other people. I had talked about how when I was an intern, we had a horrible ICU code, and one of the students that was working with me, I could see that he was about to break down. And I also knew he was someone that wanted to match in the program. So I was like very clear with him. I was like, hey, let's go over here and get this thing in order to like get him out of that room. And it was just like, I was like, hey, there's, ice cream in the break room. Let's go to the break room. And we go to the break room, and then we both actually break. We start to cry. And I knew that if in that situation at that time, had he cried in front of the attending, he never would have matched there. And it wasn't so much that they didn't have feelings. It's just that we were kept told to hide it. It wasn't professional. It wasn't professional. And I'll tell you now, this generation of learners has a lot to teach us about what professionalism really is. I've been in situations with, you know, interns and residents now where it is built into the program that we're going to examine our feelings about this occurrence. And if you cry, it's just because that's what needed to happen. And you know what? I see us on the other side of that, and we're better doctors. We're actually better doctors if we're in touch with our feelings. We're actually better doctors if we say at the end of the day, we go home and we're with our families or with our dog or with our friends or with a book. We're actually better doctors if we follow the advice that we give our patients. You need time for yourself to grow yourself. And I believe the new professionalism is that it keeps reinforcing that. I believe that if someone says, I'm so busy, you're like, okay, well, let's sit down and help you not be that busy. I'm a huge meditator. And one of the things that I was taught in meditation is like, if you don't have time to meditate for 5 minutes, then sit down and meditate for 20. And I'm telling you, it's allowed me to have the right boundaries. It's allowed me to go really deep and hard into the places that I need to go because I have resilience. I have a path for my own personal healing. I know that I will get to the other side of this, and I will help this person get to the other side of this. You know, Stacy, CEO for SDFM, she always sits down with the incoming presidents, and she says, you know, what do you need? I was like, well, in the afternoons, I need at least 20 minutes to meditate. And she's like, it's going in the book. And I do that so that I can do all the other things. We are an amazing specialty. We do amazing things. We are there at some of the hardest times in people's lives and some of the greatest times in people's lives. And we cannot be there fully if we don't take care of ourselves. So the new professionalism says you take care of yourself, you take care of each other, as well as you take care of your patient. And your family is just as important as their family. And we fix problems with systems change, not by grinding down doctors. That's new profession.
That is important. And this is the new doctor, the better doctor. And I was just thinking back and reflecting on my own experiences being younger in healthcare as an industry. And you're right. When we talked about going deep before, it was going deep into the literature. And that's still important, and understanding evidence-based medicine and what's new and what's happening. But you're so on track, I think, when we talk about going deep and going deep with emotion, because how else can you connect with your patients if you can't connect with yourself? And I think about the earlier generations of interviewing for medical school. It was, what did you achieve? What were your publications? Where did you serve in leadership? Where were you recognized? And now what I hear more of is, and how did that make you feel? And what is your distance traveled? What makes you feel something? In fact, Renee, you remind me, just recently I was preparing a fourth year medical student for her residency interviews. And oh my goodness, the other thing is they're so incredibly intelligent. It's unbelievable how much they know. And as you talk about the specialty being amazing and the people going into the specialty. And I found where I was headed in my questions was, tell me more. But tell me more about a patient that made you think of this, or remind me of how that personal healthcare experience changed who you are and how you see patients. And that is indeed the new professionalism. I'm going to start coining that as well. The new professionalism is a whole person. We talk about whole person care. In primary care, how can we possibly give whole person care if we don't see ourselves as a whole person?
Yes.
And thank you for that. And I'm wondering, is that also part of what creates this new greatest generation? What are you envisioning for this new greatest generation?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because here's the thing. When you read history books and they talk about the greatest generation, the folks that basically, you know, showed up for World War II, then built America after that. I was talking about, they built the interstate highways. They expanded college to more people. They basically pushed a lot of the things forward that we take for granted now. And they set the foundations that took us to the moon. They created the foundations of what's the internet. And they did it because they had to show up. The time they came of age when the world was in turmoil, when the world was on the edge of fascism, when the world was had to question itself and say, you know, what are we going to look like? How are we going to shape? And they showed up when it was really, really hard, but mainly because they had to. And that's the thing. It's like right now, one of the reasons I think that we're on the edge of a, you know, the next greatest generation is two things. We have some of the largest generations that have ever existed. Actually, the Zs, I think, are the largest generation that's ever existed. And we are in we're in existential crisis time. The existence of humans on this planet is in question. And that is just one of the symptoms of how dysfunctional our system is. That is just a product of a dysfunctional system. Our extreme polarization in politics, still having structural racism as a mainstay of American culture, our massive, massive wealth gap that has never been like this before. The fact that, you know, the middle class is basically shrinking. You're more likely to rent or stay in your parents' house than you are to buy a house, those things. We are in a time much like the original greatest generation. We are dealing with existential threats. And what I have seen is a generation of people that say, solve this problem now. That's why I think they're going to be the next greatest generation. That's why I'm going to do everything I can to help them be the next greatest generation. Because they're like, solve it now. There's no kicking down the road. We have to make this better now. There's not a tomorrow unless we shape it. The tomorrow comes when we make it. And if we don't make it, it won't show up. So I see gun violence. Some of the largest advocates are folks that have to go through active shooter drills in their classroom. You know, you and I didn't grow up with that. I grew up with tornado drill. And, you know, we can't make laws to make tornadoes go away. And it's just, we're at the point where it's, why do I think the next greatest generation is coming? Because I think if they don't show up, we don't get another generation. I think that's where we are. I think that we are at a very pivotal point where we have the ability to shape the direction the ship is going. And I think the way we do it is actually realize we're not trying to turn a ship. We're trying to understand that we are the water system. We're bigger than just a part of this. We shape what's happening. It didn't happen to us. We made these problems, and human beings can fix these problems. And that's what I try to get across to people. When we step up, this will change. It will not change until we do. A lot of folks, when I go and do lectures, they're like, what is the health system going to look like in the future? I was like, it's going to look exactly like you want it to, because you have the ability to make it different. Gen X, we grew up in the smallest generation that had happened in a very long time. We're just trying to keep our heads down and keep going. But we've gotten to the point also where a lot of us that are in positions of power. And I think our job as Gen X is to just rip the doors off the hinges and let millennials and Zs just rush through, because we have the ability to create the space and they have the ideas and the energy to make the change. So the next generation is actually going to be a combination. And that's, I think, what's going to make it great.
Let's go. I am on board. And I really appreciate the way you laid that out, especially what we have referred to in the past as the greatest generation. And that was indeed a great generation for its time. And as you talked about, they had to show up. They had to show up for us so that we can be present now. I do hear that in your words, that the urgency is here. And it's not so much about what's happened in the future or where we're going. We're going to build that future. It will be up to us. And to your point, what a pivotal time we are in now. And that also gives me hope. It's scary. And there are some serious threats there. But like you, I am so hopeful and optimistic about these generations coming forward, because they're entering this world not only with the science, but we're putting the social back into the social sciences and social studies and what that means to us and how critical that will be to bring those worlds together. And of all specialties to do that, family medicine is perfectly positioned as we're trained in the biopsychosocial model. There's a whole other layer to that biopsychosocial concept that we touched upon before, but I do think we're equalizing more between the science and the social. Yeah. That will be important. And as we are polarized, it is up to this group, these people who are present now and working to fix this today. And that's what's so exciting about where we're headed in this country. When we talk about global warming, that's not, oh, that happens 50 years from now. That happens now. When we talk about electric vehicles or renewable energy, we're actually hitting goals that seem so far in the future before, but we are in the future. It is 2023, and we're in fact quickly closing in on the end of 2023. So as president for this year, I have a few questions for you as the president of the SDFM. What has surprised you most about your term and your experiences?
What has surprised me most is, number one, the vast amount of efforts that are constantly in place. I think what's really interesting when you get into the leadership level, you realize that we work with many organizations to try to make not just family medicine, not just education, but our world better. We're in a situation where working with the other family medicine groups like the academy and the chairs and the program directors, working as a group of people to try to help decide where do we need to go next? Where do we put family medicine? We have influence. We have influence that we do not really realize. It's policymakers look to us because they think, as we do, that our main interest is our patients and our communities. And so we are a trusted voice in policy. And I look at the people that are working at the, you know, executive levels, at the administrative levels. I look at the staff for all these organizations, the staff for SDFM, the staff for the academy. These people are dedicated. These people are brilliant. And they help us really impact things in the world. And when I look at what it means to be a family doc, and I look at the different parts of the country and how I grew up, you know, in Midwestern and Northern California, where family medicine is just like, yeah, we're primary care. I now live in the East, where there are a ton of family medicine docs that are primary care, but you don't know it because they always have them listed as primary care. And I'm like, one of my favorite things about coming East is I'm just like, no, I'm ripping off the hood. You guys are going to show up. We're family medicine. The majority of primary docs that are made in the state of Massachusetts come from family medicine, and they go into health systems that call them primary care. That's going to stop. We're going to make that stop. We're going to make the New England and the East Coast realize that we have become the basis of primary care. And if they want a good health system, they need to start recognizing that. They need to understand that we have a special contribution that is worthwhile. And so what has surprised me? It surprised me that we're very well respected and also very unheard of. And I think that being a family doc is a lot about dichotomies like that. But we're the kind of people that can hold those polarities and move forward with them. I just look at it as an opportunity. I think that's what probably surprised me the most. There's so many opportunity because we have so much to offer.
Indeed. We do have so much to offer. And in family medicine, I find that our training prepares us well to work in teams. And I really appreciate that you brought up the staff of these organizations. And much like the staff in our family organizations in family medicine, we also see that in our clinical teams. Wherever you are, I do feel like in our specialty, we make sure people have that skill, that coordination skill. And I think that's important when we realize we're not alone. At the same time, as family physicians, it takes a team of us to build that trust, to build that message. And guess what? The exciting news is family medicine is sexy again. I remember the days of Nick Pizzicano and standing up and moving forward to get this specialty on the map. And here we are yet again, recognizing the value, I'll use primary care here, and in particular in family medicine because of the people that we reach. Regardless of where we train, it's where we go and it's at the bedside that we're having that significant impact because we do it with partnership. And I think that's critical in order for us to maintain that respect and that trust and why we have been blessed with the opportunity to influence. And we don't carry that lightly. We wear that white coat. We wear that white hat. If you're a rodeo rider, you might be wearing a white 5-gallon hat. But nevertheless, this matters. So let me ask you this follow-up question, Renee. As your year at the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine comes to a close as the president, I know you're not going away. You're still going to be at the table. It may be in a different seat. So what's next for you? Where do you feel that your influence and your expertise will best serve us in the specialty and serve you?
Well, the good news is we switch at the annual conference. So I have the end of 23 and then a bit of 24, which is good. Don't forget to attend the annual conference, LA. I'll see you there. So I see the calendar year ending is actually also opening up great opportunities. I see us coming into the 2024 is going to be a very volatile year. We have a general election coming, and the campaigning around that there's no idea what can happen with that. I see us working a lot with trying to get payment policy changes, because I think one of the big things is important to realize is that primary care is not helped by fee-for-service. Primary care is harmed by fee-for-service. And I'm not sure what shape things are going to look like. There's people who want single payer. There's people who want, you know, the Kaiser plan. There's a lot of different approaches, but what's clear is fee-for-service has to go. And we have to be a part of shaping what that next payment model is going to look like. And there's lots of different places that are experimenting with different things, and we're keeping a close eye on that. I think it's also important to realize that in medicine itself, we are part of our society, but we're also looked at as leaders in our society. The choices we make about showing up is going to be really important. It is clear that the conversations that are going on need cooler heads. They need folks who can go beyond not building consensus, it's about actually making sure people's voices are heard. I think about when I take care of that one patient who is going through so much and the challenges that they're facing with, you know, the various social determinants of their health. My voice is a way of amplifying their voice. Getting that into the conversation is going to be important. I think about what is beginning right now that is going to be an important part of us being part of it. I think about artificial intelligence and how it's roaring into healthcare right now. And I think that it's going to be critically important that primary care, specifically family medicine, get in on the ground floor of that. Because what happened with the EHRs is we said, hey, we're busy seeing our patients. We're busy teaching our folks. We don't have time for that. And the specialists and the insurance companies built the monster that we have in our electronic health record. We have to get in on the ground floor with AI because of multiple things. We have to be a part of shaping it, but we also have to realize that with machine learning, basically, whatever you put in today contributes to the way it makes decisions tomorrow. And if we wait until tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow to get involved, a lot of the early foundational thinking of these systems will be established already. It is critically important that primary care engage with AI, engage with machine learning formats. And I am a big fan of, you know, the AI scribes, the artificial intelligence scribes. I don't have any financial engagement with any of them. I just know that the ones we're trialing multiple ones in my clinic right now. And my providers, my docs are finishing the day with all their charts done and go home. And that's what we need technology for. Technology shouldn't be like the EHR, which is EHR made us an enslaved class. We were serving the EHR. And what I'm hoping to get out of the AI scribes is that we are partners in care. It is part of our team. I am hoping also that this will contribute to the improvement in the EHRs, because right now, electronic health records are just good enough to make primary care docs want to quit their profession or stop all things. It's horrible. And so that is why I think part of what my encouragement is this year is get in on the ground floor with the AI scribes. Make them work for us. It's got to be a part of, you know, it's lead, follower, get out of the way this year. And we need to start being in the places where we're like family medicine leads. Those are my thoughts.
Just a few thoughts and a tall order and a necessary order and expectation for us as we go forward. As you said, fee for service has to go. I was just speaking with some colleagues of mine who are leaders, program directors of residency programs. And the conversation about how are we preparing medical students and residents to practice not in a fee-for-service world and how to crunch a work RVU, but how you deliver whole person care, advanced primary care. This is critical. And we have to teach people from the beginning. I personally see that's where one of our misses has been. We prepare them the way that we were trained, yet we were trained for a world that will not exist, should not exist in the future. So I think that's going to be really important. So as I filter down this list of a lot of responsibilities that we have, again, being important ones, and we must deliver, we've got to amplify voices. We have got to lead the AI conversation, the machine learning, and have EMRs work for us instead of us working for the EMR. I think that's important, but how do we do that? So how would you challenge our listeners to commit to one goal today? How do we accomplish this over the coming years in bite-sized form?
I think what's really helpful for folks is you have to look inward before you can look outward. So I think that the first thing I would have people understand is that in order to make those big steps forward, you have to figure out what it is that's going to allow you to be resilient. You have to build that first. I'm not joking. If that can happen, the next step is to look around you and see where your passion is in regards to helping and what's needed. When I look at what we're capable of doing as docs, as family medicine docs, yeah, we can be out there in front, but you know what? We're also really helpful supporting and being that, you know, that second follower that gets, you know, that says, yeah, that's the way we need to go. This is an important issue. These people have it right. Thinking about where are you in things? We don't always have to be the ones fixing, but we have a very strong voice in supporting also. So sometimes our best leading is by following. And, you know, there's organizations in your community that you showing up and being a part of that augments their power. It gives them a larger voice. Even just having you on their board, having you on their letterhead, whatever it is. There's folks, I want a lot more family docs to run for office. I think that I have seen a lot of youngsters. I love being that old guy. I see a lot of youngsters. I see a lot of youngsters who have really great ideas. Yeah, get out there. Realize that the people that are in policy, the people who are in politics, they are not smarter than you. They are definitely not smarter than you. And you have been in the trenches with the people who need the help. Sometimes it's important for us to step into that office. And I think that more people in that position, great, especially school boards, you know, state boards, you know, state government, local government, whatever. I think one of the best ways that we can help our patients heal is to help our society heal. And I think that we're both good listeners and we're both good at guiding people through unknown things and scary things. It's what we do. So get involved, realize that you have power. find out where your passion is and make sure you have your personal support. Maybe make sure you have your ability to be resilient and to help yourself grow. And if you have that, step up. Let's help the society heal.
Wow. I just have to pause for a moment and I've got to soak in all these words, and it's so inspiring to hear from you. I'm grateful for your leadership as the president of STFM and knowing you'll be bringing in 2024 strong. And I'm going to wrap it up for our listeners. You heard it today from Dr. Critchlow, our very own rodeo writer. She is, represents, and challenges us all to be the one that takes care of the people. The family doc. That's what we do. We are the one that takes care of the people. And in order for us to help others, we must turn inward so that we can face outward. And in such a crystal clear way, consolidate or crystallize what it's all about. It's not always about being out front. Sometimes it's leading from the back. And as family physicians, we do this well. Our best support is also our leadership. And what we are well positioned for is recognizing the difference when it's critical to be out front versus are we in the middle? Are we serving from behind? And that is the talent that we need in family medicine, that we are going to enculturate in family medicine, and we'll expect. This is what we commit to. Dr. Critchlow, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with our listeners, and thank you for your leadership at STFM.
Well, it's a joy to serve, and I adore this profession, and I really adore this specialty, and teaching and being a part of it is so awesome. So I'm glad we're all in it together.
You've been listening to the STFM podcast, produced by the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine. Visit us at stfm.org and follow us on Twitter at stfm_FM. This podcast is copyright Society of Teachers of Family Medicine 2023.